Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everyone.
It's been a little more mild in northern DMZ. Most of our ice has almost melted, not all the way there yet. Feels a little like Sugar Shack season because it's so muddy, but we're not quite at the sap is not running just yet.
Yes. Well,
I don't know how southern DMZ is feeling these days.
I would suspect that the heat and the excitement and the energy coming out of Boston and Gillette, Foxborough right now.
Oh, right, that.
Foxborough may be keeping things warm up there. I've got the pay.
What is this Omaha thing? I keep seeing Omaha in my Twitter feed. I don't know what it's talking about.
Well, that has something to do with Peyton Manning's, like, before he snaps the ball, like, the signals he gives the other, like, Omaha, Omaha! And then they hike the ball. I guess it's like, it's just telling his team something. By the way, this becomes an issue because Seattle, now Denver will not have to play in Seattle. They avoided that, but Seattle, the Seahawks, have the loudest stadium in America. And it was designed to be loud, and it actually, I think, technically caused an earthquake at one of the playoff games. And you probably couldn't hear if Peyton Manning were calling that out, and you're on his team. They intentionally make noise when the opponents are on offense to avoid giving those signals. So I don't know what Omaha means exactly, but that's a sort of shorthand for it.
So do you have picks? Are you setting your marker down? You putting money on the line here?
Yeah, I got the Patriots and the Seahawks.
Okay.
So that's going to be the Super Bowl. It'll be in New Jersey, of course. So they won't have to go into Seattle. I think if you go into Seattle, you automatically would give the Seahawks, the advantage there. But
now Super Bowl in New Jersey is a chance for Christie to shine. this is a unusual thing for the Super Bowl to be in a cold weather state. They've been doing it in Florida or Arizona or New Orleans for a very long time. And now they're trying to mix it up with having, an outdoor cold weather Super Bowl. And the question, and Christie's been kind of boastful about hosting it. And I know a few months ago he said, the plows are ready. Who cares if there's a blizzard? We're ready for it. Now, Christie's management of the state infrastructure is obviously come into question lately. One wonders if he has a strong grip on it. I guess the question usually is that he's too strong a grip on it. But certainly if there was any kind of problems traffic-wise or snowplow-wise in Super Bowl, that would clearly add to his troubles.
Yeah, I haven't heard too much about this. I mean, they're billing it as New York, even though I think it's technically in New Jersey.
Right.
And there's like...
I mean, New York is not in control of the snowplows for Giant Stadium.
Right. And it's insane to do it there, by the way. You should never do the Super Bowl in an winter outdoor venue. I mean, it should be in, like, New Orleans or San Diego something.
To quote Matt Lewis, is nothing sacred.
No, because it's a party. It's not just the Super Bowl game. I mean, it's a whole like event, and you should be able to enjoy it. And the weather could be horrible. And you don't want the elements to impact a Super Bowl game. I mean, you want the best team to win, and bad weather can hurt certain parts of the game that might be your strength. So it could.
Shouldn't the best Super Bowl team be able to handle the elements? Shouldn't that be a criteria for who's the best?
Maybe, but I think the fans want to see also like a game where people get to execute their best stuff. And so, for example, San Diego got beat last weekend, but San Diego may not fare as well in really bad weather as like Green Bay or New England or something. So,
My Y chromosome senses are tingling. I think San Francisco beat Green Bay at Lambeau Field. Am I correct?
You are, but it was like 40 degrees. Oh no, I'm sorry.
The wind chills didn't kick in.
Oh no, I'm sorry. You're right. You're right. That game was like around zero, I think. No, actually, here's the interesting thing. Tony Kornheiser had this one nailed, I think, ahead of the fact. It was very cold in Green Bay. I think it was around zero, maybe wind chills below zero. But his argument was that the reason the 49ers won is that Colin Kaepernick, the 49ers quarterback, is a good runner, and that in cold weather, bad weather, running is better than passing. So maybe that's like revisionist history, but anyway. So here's the other deal, though.
With that in mind, who would come out ahead of Patriots Seahawks? Who has the better run?
That is a good question. I think now the 49ers may beat the Seahawks, and then I would have to go with the 49ers. It's unclear. I mean, the Patriots are traditionally thought of as like Tom Brady slinging the ball down the field, but they've been running it a lot more this year. But not, they don't have like a really well-known, I mean, all, their best players are essentially going to jail or or injured. So that's what's so remarkable. That's why I've become, like, after a dozen years, I've finally become a Tom Brady fan, grudgingly. Like, I'm not jumping on the bandwagon. Like, you know, it's you have to admire.
You're tied to a rope to the bandwagon across the jagged glass of the road.
Yes. Yes, I should have jumped on this bandwagon years ago, but I just have come to admire his toughness. But here's the other thing regarding Christie. I think this is one of those years where there's like 2 weeks between Sunday's playoff game and the Super Bowl. So
that's standard, I think.
They go back and forth. Sometimes it's just sometimes it's just 1 week. Sometimes it's two. I think more often than not, it's been 2 weeks, but I prefer 1 week, but in any event. So this is, you know, weeks down the road. So there really could be bad weather that we're not even seeing yet on extended forecasts. By the same token, Christie could have, his scandal could have subsided a little bit by the time the Super Bowl rolls around. So we'll have to wait and see.
So are you of the mind that this will pass? He's weathered the storm? Or do you have a sense that there are a whole lot of shoes to drop? There's lots of people who haven't talked yet. There's still subpoenas to be issued. There's still David Wildstein's suggestion he might talk more if he gets immunity. We haven't heard from Richard Kelly. We haven't heard from David Sampson. What do you think the sense is of Christie's staying power here?
I mean, I think if I had to bet, I think that he will endure this. As everyone knows, I mean, if there is some sort of a smoking gun directly linking him to this, then I think he's toast. But I suspect he weathers the storm and survives. The question, though, is in terms of his like national ambitions, like to what degree
is survival sufficient?
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, you can like weather the storm, but still be weakened. Have your powers greatly diminished. And so, you know, it doesn't have to be like an absolute thing that takes him down and gets him impeached to like really hurt his chances of being the Republican nominee. And we've already seen the numbers. I mean, he has now like dropped substantially in terms of the direct face-to-face matching up against Hillary Clinton and electability.
Right.
Electability and was essentially his, you know, claim to fame or his argument, his raison.
I had a piece over at The Week this week looking at the most recent poll numbers. I published a few hours before the most recent NBC poll, which numbers were slightly different. But looking back at the handful of polls that happened over the course of the last month or so, Christie was at the top, but around like 16-17%. This is national poll. I didn't look at the state polls for this. And we're talking about just Republican primary voters here. And then generally right under him in the low teens is the Tea Party favorites, Rand Paul and Ted Cruz. And also clustered around those low double digits have been Jeb Bush and Paul Ryan, but Paul Ryan almost surely is not running. All the reporting is he's angling for a House Ways and Means chair and planting his flag in the House. And Jeb Bush so far hasn't really done anything to suggest he is running. He hasn't, you know, started lining up staff or visiting the early primary stage or things like that. So that's just, he could jump in, but I wouldn't presume that. So if Jeb doesn't, and Christie is weakened enough by this that he no longer is a firewall preventing a Cruz or a Paul from being in the top slot. You know, we've talked about this in the past about the brackets, the establishment bracket versus the popular slash Tea Party bracket. You know, does the establishment bracket collapse? Is there really just no contender there if Christie is weakened? And if the establishment doesn't consolidate around a relatively moderate choice, which is what usually happens in Republican primaries, despite people's presumptions, usually the establishment consolidates and the far right fractures among several candidates and the establishment pick wins. If Christie is fatally weakened, is there nothing stopping Cruz or Paul from getting it? So they could even have a bit of a rivalry there, and they wouldn't cannibalize each other because they'd just be the top dogs. And all the other folks, Rubio, Walker, Santorum, these guys have all been, you know, scraping the bottom of polls for a while now. They've all had their missteps. What say you? Is there a chance here that this is a recipe for Tea Party ascendance? And if that is true, is that chunk of the party that's moderate, and some people have mocked me for saying that it still exists, but polls show 25% of the Republican Party are self-described moderates, would they walk if a Christie no longer is a viable contender and Rand Paul and Cruz become the top dog?
I'm skeptical about the 25%, but I do think that the bigger concern is, does the money show up? Do they walk? Do they just sit on the money? A lot of the money people are more moderate, and they want to pick a winner, and so they may just, you know, sit out, and that's a bigger danger. I think we also just have to, I hate to be like the sort of party pooper who like steps on like good stories, but it is important to remind ourselves. I mean, you know, a year and a half ago, Marco Rubio, I thought he was the guy, and 6 months ago, I mean, during the shutdown, Chris Christie looked amazingly good. And so, you know, what's it going to look like a year from now? Like, will Christie be back on top, or will Rubio be back on top, and will Rand Paul have had a major stumble, or Cruz? So, I mean, a lot of things can happen, can play out. And I also think that I would still argue that Rubio and Walker are undervalued right now. Like, I think that where they're polling doesn't accurately represent their potential. I mean, I think both can be the hybrid compromise candidate that's acceptable to conservatives and to the establishment, depending on how things shake out. I mean, in the past, you've had people like Pawlenty who sought to occupy that space. It didn't work for him, but I mean, I would argue that for one thing, he didn't have the charisma or the political chops of a Rubio. So, you know, it's still early, but I think that while I wouldn't want to say that this bridge gate is the end all and be all in terms of 2016, I also wouldn't want to like dismiss it and write it off either. I just think it's, you know, one more data point on the way. Now, what I have done, Bill, as you know, is I have written some sort of thought pieces that are like the Christie Bridgegate thing is like tangential to some other larger points that I've made. And one of them is the argument that Christie, that this Bridgegate thing, aside from it being problematic in and of itself, was also like a canary in the coal mine that sort of illustrated that Christie doesn't have a base. That, you know, the reason that a lot of conservatives aren't flocking to defend him is in itself problematic. You know, the very fact that they aren't demonstrates what happens when you're a Republican and your base is the Acela corridor or the media or the establishment who just want to win, then once you are no longer the guy who can win, they will abandon you. And so I think that Christie may have built his house upon the sand a little bit. And when the storm comes along, as a very bad metaphor, it may wash it away.
I mean, it seems like a minimum, even if he's not, you know, criminally liable or impeached or what have you, if there's no smoking gun, it does raise the question, how does this guy play the game? Can he withstand the pressure of presidential level scrutiny? Is he going to hire the right kind of staff? Is he going to get himself in another kind of scrape like this down the line? It just seems, you know, before where he was like a sort of, a electoral powerhouse. Look what I can do in a blue state. I can win in a landslide, and this is exactly what we need right now. You need my kind of, boastful style. Now everyone sees there's a flip side to all those strengths come with weaknesses,
right?
Inherently. It's just got to at least make people pause. And if it's making you pause, I'm not saying that he couldn't gut it out. Obviously it is several months away. All those sort of things can change. But it would seem like it becomes a lot harder for him to consolidate establishment support and prevent a Paula Cruz, who I think of all the people we're mentioning, those are the guys who have the biggest fans right now. I mean, they're not crushing these polls either. They're not breaking 20%, but they have fervent supporters. And if one of them eventually, bowed to the other so that that vote could consolidate and become more like 35-40, whatever chops Ruby or Walker have, if they can't consolidate, then I think a Paul could pull it off.
Well, and this plays into a couple things that I wrote this week, one of which is an argument for tribalism. And I'm keying off of something that Connor Friedersdorf at The Atlantic wrote. He basically took Rush Limbaugh's segment this week, where Limbaugh basically said, back in the early 90s, I defended Clarence Thomas, basically because I assumed he was right, and I knew the left was trying to take, claim a conservative scalp, and I just sort of assumed he was a good man, and reflexively, I mean, I'm sort of paraphrasing, obviously, but Limbaugh reflexively defended Clarence Thomas, and Limbaugh basically goes on to say, now why aren't we reflexively defending Chris Christie? And it's because he's not ideologically pure. He's not one of us. We don't trust him. And I thought that was, number one, a really interesting admission for Limbaugh to kind of concede the fact that that loyalty to politicians has, more to do with their perceived ideological purity than it does with the perception of guilt or innocence. But I suspect it's entirely true, and it's how a lot of people operate. And, there's an argument for joining a gang, basically, that if you're Chris Christie and you build your base around being a winner and the media liking you and Bruce Springsteen liking you, that's very dangerous because they're going to flip on you eventually. And, of course, the conservative base isn't going to be there to have your back. This is one of the reasons I think that there are these forces drawing politicians to the right and to the left, because they will have your back. And I think the same sort of is true in punditry and in the commentary world, where if you're thought of as being kind of a free agent who calls them, intellectually honest, call them like you see them, then your fans are going to be people who are intellectually honest and call them like they see them, and they probably aren't going to have your back if you get into a skirmish. But if you get into a fight with, a hardcore conservative right-wing blogger, let's say, their support base is going to have their back whether they're right or wrong. So essentially, I think that this is an argument for Cruz and Paul, that at least, their support base is going to stick with them through thick and thin. Whereas I think Christie, it was very sort of, his support was was contingent on him being perceived as a winner, sort of like ethereal, you know, ephemeral. I mean, you know, that's a dangerous thing.
He doesn't have a real posse. He just has himself.
I think so. I mean,
I
think that, like, remember John McCain? Remember how John McCain joked that the media were his base?
Right.
I think John McCain might be a prime example of, like, the danger of being a maverick and not having a base. And, you know, my dad was a prison guard. And so a lot of my stories growing up, like, you know, if your dad's like an accountant, you probably talk about numbers a lot. So, I mean, I think in terms of, like, the first thing a lot of people do when they go to prison is join a gang, you know? You want, it doesn't even matter, like, you could be, join the Muslims, whatever it is, but, you know, you want somebody to have your back, and I think that politics and punditry can sort of be the same, and it's actually very dangerous to be a free agent, to be an independent thinker, and to not pick a side, and I think that's, like, maybe one of the lessons here with Chris Christie. You know, when you're in trouble, when the bridge thing hits, you don't have people running to your, to reflexively. Conservatives are basically saying, you know, they're sort of defending him with caveats and, like, well, if he's not guilty, you know, they're not, it's not a full-throated defense of Christie. And really what I think you want in politics is people who will defend you whether you're right or wrong. And
you know, and as you say this, you know, it sounds very unethical.
It's unseemly.
It sounds anti-intellectual. You know, it sounds like you're recommending that people become lemmings and not think for themselves. They should just leap to the defense of anybody, you know, my country right or wrong kind of, you know, blind patriotism, you know, sort of deal. And obviously there's risks to that. There are risks to jumping in head first if you don't know the full story. But I think there is also evidence that without that kind of tribal loyalty, it's hard to actually get things done once you are in a position of power. And in fact, if I may lead on books that I've read recently, you know, Woodrow Wilson, you know, before he was president, was a political scientist, and he was a proselytizer, an early proselytizer of partisanship, which was sort of a new concept, that, you know, that you need to have a party machinery to execute. If you don't have that, you can't execute. And he brought that thinking, you know, to his governorship and to his presidency. And he was proven right that once he is in a situation where his party wasn't in charge of Congress and he had to get the League of Nations through, he wasn't able to do it. And if you don't have that tribal loyalty, you know, I mean, FDR, you know, had a very, and Wilson too, I mean, their parties were not ideologically cohesive, but there was a bigger sense of party loyalty that both of them fostered that allowed them to get things through that some people in their party weren't so sure right. about.
There's an old story, Bill. I don't know if it's FDR or LBJ or Tip O'Neill, but somebody will know in the comments. But it basically goes like this. One of his lieutenants said, you know, Tip, I'll be with you. As long as you're right, I'm always going to be with you. And the politician said, I don't need friends when I'm right. I need them when I'm wrong.
right. So, I mean, there's always a degree of, you know, internal contradiction and cognitive dissonance when you're dealing with the real world of politics. You know, if everything was, like, you know, totally pure from top to bottom, you know, everyone would just be in their own little individual silos and things, people wouldn't come together and do things. So, you know, there is a certain, there's, you know, I'm not saying this means no one should think for themselves ever and we should defend our most scurrilous party members regardless of the situation. But there is a degree of logic to that. And right. You know, from Russia's standpoint, he's saying, if you agree with...
Let me stop you, but I do want to hear what you have to say about Rush. But you said something, you said rational or you said logic. That's my point. I'm not advocating this, but I'm saying that it is a logical response that that when politicians go to the right or go to the left, this is a very rational decision. Now, I would say personally, I have not followed that path. I have chosen to not follow that path, and I think that it can be perilous at times. But you cannot fault the smart, politician for keeping a secure home base, dancing with the one that brung them. There's another saying: you can't make friends of your enemies by making enemies of your friends. I think Chris Christie maybe thought he could, but when politicians sort of engage in this tribalism, when bloggers engage in this tribalism, it is a completely rational decision that makes a lot of sense.
Now, and you wrote a piece this week also about virtue that I want to segue into.
But first, though, you were going to talk about Rush. I interrupted you. What were we going to say about
Rush? Right, I can draw that line. I mean, where I think Rush is running a bigger risk, and I think people on the left do this too, is saying, if you share my ideological worldview, I have an innate trust that you are not unethical.
Right.
And therefore, I'm going to take the leap of faith that you're in the right and defend you. And look, there are bad apples, across the spectrum. There are unethical liberals and unethical conservatives and unethical moderates. There's no...
Absolutely. I found that the people who try to sell you on their purity, who wear it on their sleeve, are so often the most corrupt. I mean, there are a ton. Look, I have no doubt that conservative philosophy is best for this nation, but I also have no doubt that some of the worst people and the biggest con artists are, professional conservatives. I'm under no, illusion that that's not the case. So.
Right. And I think everyone, those who want to foster a healthy tribalism, don't want to get upended by having a massive blind spot. Whether or not you believe, Clarence Thomas, told the truth, I could see one saying, well, we got away with that one. that worked out. So I might as well just defend all comers. And, that might not, be in one's best interest. So it's a fine line you got to walk when you got to cut somebody loose. You had a piece this week talking about the value of being virtuous, which... cuts against a lot of political history that kind of celebrate roguishness.
Right.
Some folks, when you get caught in the act, you get burned. But when you get away with it, it's talked about after the fact, you're celebrated as pulling it off. Everyone loves that LBJ was a political bully, and everyone love the fact that Lee Atwater, got down in the muck to get his people elected, and people love the fact that there's this mysterious...
Yeah, we glamorize these things and lionize them.
Right. People love the baseball cheaters of old, and they're playing them in the Hall of Fame, but we lambast the steroid era because they got caught.
Right.
So this is true in all sorts of life. But I think you raise an interesting point that if you can find the way to success while being virtuous, that's kind of, that's the best of all worlds. And to suggest that you have to, for Democrats in the Bush era, there was a sense that we have to find we need our Karl Rove. We have to find a way to play dirty, else we'll always get beat. And I'm sure the baseball players say, I got to take steroids because that guy's taking steroids. Otherwise, I got no choice. But if you can find an alternate path, that's not going to be maybe goody-goody, but combine, an element of toughness along with virtue, that's really, that's pretty unstoppable. And I mean, I'm sure you want to talk about your own piece more in your own words, but you know, I would argue that Obama is actually providing that model of politics in a way that, you know, I mean, FDR ran some nasty campaigns and LBJ ran some nasty campaigns. And I think that Obama, you know, I know conservatives have their complaints. I know there's this whole culture of corruption meme out there, so I know they're not going to buy what I'm saying. But I think if you actually looked at the historical arc here, Obama plays the game pretty clean and has gotten a lot of stuff done, in part because when he had his party in power, he used his partisan machinery, Wilson style, to get what he could done. And when that didn't happen, he made his adjustments, but he never, I don't think he ever went down in the gutter and really slung the mud in the way that politicians have throughout the course of American history. And I hope that the Democratic bench sees how Obama does and replicates it and doesn't think that he's a one-off. And I think Republicans should look at how Obama plays the game and say, you know what, maybe we don't have to do it the Karl Rove way or the Chris Christie way. There are other ways that our ideology can triumph without doing that kind of stuff. But I don't know that's where you were headed with your piece.
Well, I mean, look, I've written pretty extensively about this Christie thing, and you could argue, like, well, maybe you can't get ahead in New Jersey without playing hardball and without being, you know, maybe a Boy Scout couldn't survive in New Jersey, and this is sort of a larger culture of New Jersey. There's also the whole staff infection issue, where, you know, rogue staffers who think they're literally at Waters, and that's really what this virtuous piece was addressing. I mean, there's the macro question of whether or not a party or a president can win by sort of playing softball, but I think there's the micro issue of, if I'm talking to a young political operative or whatever, what is the best survival strategy for them? And I think you can play really hardball politics and be very tough without being unethical or mean or evil. So that is a distinction that I think is possible. I'm not sort of advocating being like a weenie who isn't tough, but I think clearly when you like shut down these lanes, that is obviously crossing the line. So, but
would you say in recent conservatism that roguish actors like, say, I can't remember the guy's name now. O'Keefe, James O'Keefe, the Acorn guy, like when he, you know, went undercover and selectively edited videos and ambushed people. I mean, he was embraced very, very readily by the conservative movement. I mean, there seems to be an encouragement to kind of, you know, do underhanded stuff like that, which I don't think is as celebrated on the left in that way. Does that trouble you that kind of behavior is encouraged?
I think that there is on both sides of the aisle. I mean, they'll criticize me for the moral equivalence thing here, but I honestly do believe that there is a sort of celebration of this stuff on both sides of the aisle. However, when I wrote this piece, I wasn't really thinking of people like O'Keefe. I was thinking of people like Christie's deputy chief of staff and professional political operatives.
This is Stepien?
No. The lady Bridget. Always remember that because it starts with Bridge.
I said because, you know, Steve Kornacki and MSNBC did kind of like a character study of all the different players here, and his telling, because he knows a lot of these people personally, right, from his Jersey journalism career, he was saying that Stepien had the rep of being the underhanded petty one, and Bridget Kelly had the reputation of being clean.
Right.
And that it was sort of interesting that she seems to be sort of dragged into this, and what brought her from, you know, one camp to the other is kind of a bit of a mystery. But that is undercut, I think, what you're saying in general.
Yeah, no, I think there's so many variables here. I mean, if you're a 25-year-old, let's just say you're a 25-year-old who manages a campaign, and your guy gets elected to Congress and you come to D.C., you have basically two options. You can either slow things down, take your time and learn how things work, and you're going to miss opportunities and possibly get fired or replaced by an old DC hand, or you can kind of try to punch above your weight and play above your game, which is very risky and dangerous. Now, let's suppose that there's a more seasoned general consultant or political advisor who's a little devious and unethical, who takes you under your wing. It would be very tempting to follow the advice, even if you started off as a good person. It's very seductive. And I think this happens, that a lot of people get sucked into, you know, this is how it works. This is how, you know, this is how you win. Listen to me. I'm going to take, what are you going to say? No. We go back to Montana or wherever you're from. I mean, it's a very tough thing. What I'm advising is that I think it's important, you know, for political operatives and for all of us to really guard our hearts. I think if you have like a family and you attend religious services and you have friends and a community and things, you're not just defining yourself, your self-worth and your identity by politics. It's much easier to not be sucked into that sort of peer pressure and to not get caught up in the game to the point where you like think that you're in The Godfather. I mean, I think a lot of political operatives get sucked into like this posturing themselves as gangsters, you know, and glamorizing the Atwaters and of the world. And in my piece, I talk about, you know, Michael Corleone, The Godfather, which I think a lot of political, I love the Godfather movies. I think a lot of political people do, but I think some of them are like living vicariously through it. And it maybe especially in New Jersey. And the point I make is that Michael Corleone ends up losing everything he loved. I mean, his whole attempt was to save his family and to keep his family together. And at the end, he dies alone, peeling an orange. And that's the moral. That's the lesson.
I believe, as did Lee Atwater.
Right. You could say that, absolutely. But I don't think people get to that. They don't get to Godfather 3. They don't get to Lee Atwater at the end. They're glamorized, and Hollywood's very much guilty of this. I mean, as a rule, you know, of sort of glamorize, you know, young people who are impressionable, they never think about the end, about Atwater on his deathbed or whatever. They think about him banging hot chicks at some convention, whatever, you know, taking down
like Dick Morris in 96.
Taking sucking toes, taking down, you know, Michael Dukakis, showing, mocking him riding around in the tank. And I'm just sort of suggesting that it's very important to have, for all of us, because we can all F up and make mistakes. God knows I have. But if you have that infrastructure to keep you grounded, you're less likely to. I don't know what happens to her. I don't know if she could be, you know, rehabilitated or not, but I suspect that she got sucked into this.
Now, is it possible that, I mean, you know, the Christie team now has a reputation of political payback, whereas, you know, the Obama campaign team has a reputation of being data nerds. You know, no one looks at David Plouffe and Jim Messina and David Axelrod as being, you know, knife wielders. But, you know, they're pretty well lionized right now because they've won twice. Whereas, you know, we've had a lot of glamorization of Harbaugh operatives, you know, going back, you know, several decades now. Does our cultural standards change? In part because we have a model that works that's not as cutthroat, and because we're in a different kind of media era where it's a lot easier to get caught, and people don't cover things up as readily. People know that when a story is told like this, you get clicks sharing it quickly and not saving it for a book 5 years later. Does that change our expectations, our cultural standards, and does that eventually change behavior at the operative level?
That's an interesting question. So obviously, you know, Obama did have Rahm Emanuel, and I think as Nixon said of Spiro Agnew, when you own a dog, you don't have to bark. So he did have his attack dog, at least for a while. And we also have Hillary Clinton, you know, apparently having this enemies list. So I don't want to say that, like, that that they're, you know, entirely virtuous and that they're not playing hardball. But I do think you're right. I mean, the perception is that they speak softly and carry a big stick, that they're able to win and be, you know, I have to say my philosophy has always been out of the Roadhouse. I mean, there's this Patrick Swayze, ridiculous Patrick Swayze movie called Roadhouse. I don't know if you've seen it, but he's a bouncer and he comes into this bar and he's like giving this like really great inspirational speech to all the losers who work at this bar. And he says, like, if someone is having a problem, we're going to go up to them and we're going to ask them to leave and we're going to ask them nicely. And someone says, like, well, what if they take a punch at us? And he's like, well, then we'll walk them to the door and we'll do so nicely. And someone says, well, what if a couple of his friends come over? And you know, Swayze says, well, then two or three of us will, you know, we'll come over and we will escort them out and we will do so nicely. We will be nice until it is time to not be nice. And I think that's sort of my philosophy is you can tell people to go to hell, but have them looking forward to the trip, right? You can be a very nice person and still fire people and, you know, all that. And I think Obama, to a certain degree, has done that. If it continues, I mean, if that trend continues, I think it could change the culture. You could have people emulating that. It does remind me a little bit of football, right? So there's a time when, you know, smash mouth football is all the rage and the teams that are just running the ball and pounding, you know, that's what everybody emulates. And then you'll have a more like, I don't know, like nuanced sort of offense that's softer, that maybe, you know, becomes the rage for a while. And so maybe that will be something that comes out of this, that you'll have a culture or a generation of political operatives who are more data nerds, and that gets rewarded and incentivized as opposed to the sort of hardball politicians. Like, that being a finesse pitcher becomes the cool thing in the future.
Do we have something else we want to talk about? I don't remember if we exhausted our topics or not.
I think I've exhausted my topics and probably my knowledge.
Well, Patriots Country, appreciate your faith.
Yes. I'm on the bandwagon. I'll be wearing my Uggs with Tom and sitting next to my, equally hot wife pulling for the Patriots.
In your pajamas, drinking hot chocolate.
In my pajamas, drinking hot chocolate. Absolutely. Holding the cup like this. Cause that's how I roll. Yeah. So it's going to be a...
But at least you're watching football. You're not completely, you know, destroying the masks and pillows of society.
Sports is like one of the only things that, like, when I grew up in a really rural area in Western Maryland, and my whole family, like, hunts and fishes and stuff. And I would say sports and music were the two things that, like, that I could identify with, my male relatives on, because I wasn't much, the idea of sitting in a tree in the cold weather, and if all goes right, you get to kill a deer and then you have to like drag it. Like, that didn't appeal to me, but luckily sports and, music were bonding, opportunities.
Excellent. Well, enjoy your Sunday.
Yes.
Is it all on Sunday or is there Saturday games? I don't know anymore.
I think this week both games are on Sunday. I think the early game's like 3, and then the Seahawks 49ers, I think it's at 6 Eastern. But the last 2 weeks have been Saturday and Sunday with the playoffs.
And does Erin join you, or does she go off and do other things?
No, she doesn't watch. She doesn't get into it, but I'm fine with that. It's sort of just on. You know, she doesn't complain, so that's a good thing.
You'll at least have some family time on Saturday.
Yeah. Yeah, which
he doesn't lose you for the entire weekend.
No. I rarely, like, unless it's the Redskins or the Super Bowl, like, if I don't put, like, sports ahead of, you know, family stuff as a rule.
So, good man.
Good man. That those are the values that we're trying to instill. Those are the virtues.
Oh, well, until next week, enjoy your Sunday, yeah. And we'll catch you next week here in the DMZ.